This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. The vote is still being tallied, but it appears another Oregon county is Idaho curious. The Greater Idaho Movement is on a long-shot quest to supersize Idaho by absorbing more than a dozen eastern Oregon counties, a big chunk of Oregon's territory. On Tuesday, Wallowa County, a rural area of far northeast Oregon, voted on a ballot measure to require county commissioners to discuss the possibility of moving the Idaho-Oregon state line westward. As of this broadcast, the measure is passing with the slimmest of slim margins, 7 votes. Over the past couple years, 11 other Oregon counties have passed similar ballot measures asking their county commissioners to talk about joining Idaho. Moving state borders needs approval by the Idaho and Oregon state legislatures, plus an act of Congress, so this is highly unlikely to ever actually happen. But Greater Idaho spokesman Matt McCaw says there's a reason the campaign's message is landing with a lot of rural voters. They feel disenfranchised by Oregon's political power center, Portland.
The west side of Oregon is very different than the east side of Oregon. The west side of Oregon votes very democratically left-leaning. It's more urban. It's wealthier. It's less agricultural. The east side of the state is conservative, rural, has a different economy, votes differently. And what happens in the state of Oregon, and this is true of a lot of states, but it's especially pronounced in Oregon, is that Oregon has one major urban area, and that's the Portland metro area. And that Portland metro area has 2 million people. So whatever the Portland metro area decides statewide gets implemented across the state of Oregon. And there's nothing really that Eastern Oregonians can do about it, even if that's not at all what they want for their communities, even if they vote overwhelmingly against whatever policies are being enacted. They simply don't have the numbers to be able to overcome the west side of the state. And so what that does, Libby, is it causes this mass political tension, because the west side of Oregon is very left-leaning, wants a certain kind of government, wants a certain kind of policies for their communities. The east side of the state is polar opposite on almost every issue, very conservative, votes like Idaho, lives their lives like Idaho, would prefer to have the state governance of Idaho. And so that's where we've come in as an organization, and we've said, let's ask the people directly. We know we have this huge urban-rural divide in Oregon that causes all this political tension. People have been looking for a solution. What if we move the state line and move the border, which is an imaginary line and can be moved, and there's a process for moving it. What if we move that border so that these eastern Oregon counties, which are much more similar to Idaho than they are to western Oregon, what if they got their state level governance from Idaho instead of Oregon? And so we've been going county by county and asking voters directly. And what voters are telling us is, we love this idea. We want our elected leaders to pursue this idea.
What are the actual policies that the Idaho legislature, in your mind, gets right while the Oregon legislature flubs?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, I'm not sure how familiar your listeners are with Oregon politics, but there's been a few statewide ballot measures that have passed in the last few years that have caused all sorts of political tension and really highlight the difference between the west side and the east side and the problems of having two different cultures grouped together in the same state. So in 2020, there was a ballot measure, statewide ballot measure in Oregon. It was called Ballot Measure 110. And that ballot measure legalized possession of hard drugs across the state.
Yeah, Measure 110 makes possession of small amounts of drugs like cocaine, LSD, and meth punishable by a civil citation. So it's like a parking ticket and a $100 fine. And supporters say that's in the interest of treating people, getting them the help they need instead of criminalizing the use of drugs.
This was an idea that kind of started on the west side of the state. It was a policy that they thought made sense for their communities. The people in Eastern Oregon did not want this policy at all. They voted, every single county in Eastern Oregon voted against this. But because we're only talking about 400,000 people in Eastern Oregon, it didn't matter that every county in Eastern Oregon voted against it and said, we don't want this policy. The west side of the state passed the measure, passed it with enough votes to overwhelm the east side of the state, and it's caused a massive amount of frustration, political tension. So that's one issue. In this last election in 2022, we had a gun control bill that was also on the statewide ballot in Oregon. So again, Western Oregon, the people in Western Oregon are more left-leaning. They're less pro-Second Amendment. They feel like they need certain gun restrictions to make their communities safer. And that's fine. You know, people know what they need to make their communities better. And that's our movement is about self-determination. And our whole point is Western Oregon's different than Eastern Oregon. And what makes sense for Western Oregon doesn't make sense for Eastern Oregon. So it doesn't make sense for either one of these groups to be dictating policy to the other.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you the question that everybody asks you. If you're not happy with the Oregon legislature and the decisions it's making, and you look and you see a red state that you agree with more, why not just move?
Well, we're talking about 400,000 people in Eastern Oregon. A lot of these people have lived in their communities for generations. They own lots of land. They built these communities. So you're asking people to break up their communities, leave their family, land, and legacy because they're getting policy that doesn't make sense for their communities dictated to them from an urban area that's hundreds of miles away. That doesn't make any sense. It makes far more sense to almost everybody to move the state line and get people the government they want. Self-determination matters. A core principle in the United States is people having government they want. We vote every 2 years so that people can say, is this the government we want? Or do we want to change what that government looks like? We redistrict every 10 years so that we can use imaginary lines to group similar peoples together so that they have better representation. We can do this with state lines. We should do this with state lines because where that state line is right now between Idaho and Oregon doesn't make sense and is causing more problems than it's solving. We could move it, solve problems, lower political tension, and get good outcomes.
The Claremont Institute, which is a conservative think tank based at Claremont College, published a study in February that looked at the economic impact of moving the Oregon-Idaho border. And the study pointed out that taxpayers in Northwest Oregon currently subsidize Eastern and Southern Oregon taxpayers to the tune of about $363 a person per year. The Idahoan taxpayers, if these counties did end up joining Idaho, would also be subsidizing these parts of Oregon, although to a lesser degree, about $42 a person. Now, if this effort went through and Idaho expanded into Eastern Oregon, Idaho would also end up owing $4 to $6 billion in debt through the absorption of these converting Oregon counties. This doesn't seem like a great deal for Idaho. Matt, why would Idaho want to do this?
Well, there's a lot of advantages for the state of Idaho. So that economic analysis that you were talking about from the Claremont Institute, it did indeed show that right now, Western Oregon subsidizes Eastern Oregon because Eastern Oregon is less wealthy than Western Oregon. That would not necessarily be the case, however, if Eastern Oregon moved into Idaho. So what that economic analysis found is that if you took those and just straight across, there would be a very small subsidy from the rest of Idaho because Eastern Oregon is very similar to Idaho counties in almost every way, and that there would actually be multiple ways that policies that are already in place could be left in place that would make not a subsidy to the state of Idaho, but an economic benefit to the state of Idaho and a tax benefit. And just one of those ways the study showed would bring in an extra $170 million to the state of Idaho.
A spokesperson for a political group that spent money opposing the Wallawa ballot measure, that group is called Western State Center, argues that your campaign echoes past efforts by white nationalist movements and paramilitary groups to form their own independent states in the Pacific Northwest. The Eastern Oregon counties that are seeking to leave Oregon are less diverse than the west side of the state, and this effort would have them join one of the whitest states in the country, Idaho. Is this about race?
Well, we feel like that's a baseless smear. You know, our movement has nothing to do with race. Our movement has everything to do with self-determination and matching voters up and citizens up to government that they actually want. So for people that don't live here, live hundreds of miles away, they don't understand us, they don't share our values to make baseless claims of racism or anything else, it's disappointing, it's frustrating, but it has nothing to do with our movement.
Now, phase one is a long shot. By anybody's estimate, this would take agreement between the Oregon and Idaho legislature. It would then have to go to an act of Congress. I mean, the likelihood of this happening is very, very far off. That's phase one. In phase two, you have your sights set on parts of Washington State, our state, and Northern California. What does that look like? I mean, would you be trying to take in Pullman, for example? Is this like a play for Cougar football?
I think it's important, Libby, to understand we're not taking anything. What we're trying to do is change state governance for people that are not happy with the state level governance that they have. So, you know, people often think, well, Idaho is going to take all this land from Oregon. Oregon doesn't own Eastern Oregon. Oregon governs over Eastern Oregon. Eastern Oregon is about 50% federal land and about 50% private land. The people who live here own their land. They get their governance from the state of Oregon because of where a line was put 164 years ago. And we can update that line because their governance they're getting no longer matches their values and it doesn't match what they want for their communities. So when you talk about a phase two, our goal is to get people government that they want and matches their values. And so in Washington, you have the same sort of issue as you do in Oregon, where you have the west side of the state. You have King County is very left-leaning. It's very populist. And so what happens on the west side of the state kind of overwhelms what voters on the east side of the state want. So would it make sense after we get these Eastern Oregon counties into Idaho governance to look at Eastern or Eastern Washington counties that may want to join? Absolutely. But we're not going to force or you know anybody to do anything.
What would happen if this idea of, okay, self-determination means finding the government that suits your political position, and you saw more and more rural parts of states deciding to detach from their blue cities and suburbs across the country. And then maybe blue cities in the middle of red states would want to break away. Doesn't it all get pretty messy? I mean, at what point does this end? So your goal is to break off and join a state that you agree with more politically. Shouldn't you be going and making a case at the legislature for your policies and running and winning elections and really taking the democratic process at face value here?
Yes. So we think it's important, and most Americans agree that people have government that they want that matches their values. And like I mentioned earlier, we go to a lot of effort to give people that opportunity to change out their government. If they're not happy with their government, we redistrict, we do a lot of things. The truth is, Libby, that we already have two very different cultures in this country. We have an urban culture that's very different than the rural culture. And so those already exist, whether we're grouped together in the same state and who's in charge. And the political tension and the political frustration and comes from when you have either one of those groups that have very different ways of looking at the world, very different worldviews, very different value sets, and very different ways that they want their community set up. When you have either of those two groups dictating and forcing policy on the other that they don't want, that doesn't make sense for their communities, you're going to have problems. And that's where you get political tension.
Let's zoom out to a national level. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia has begun talking about the idea of a national divorce. Of course, echoes of the Civil War there between red and blue states. Do you support the idea of a national divorce?
To be clear, our movement is not advocating for national divorce. What our movement is advocating for is using state lines to better group similar-minded people and lower political tension and get people government that they want. So, you know, I think that we can rally around things that we all agree on. In the United States, people, you know, freedom, democracy, there's a lot of ideas that we hold in common and are similar on. But there's a lot of issues where we're not. And in those issues where we're not, the tension comes when one group's trying to force their policies, their way of life on the other. So we should try to get people the government that makes most sense for their communities. And that's the best path forward for lowering this tension. You know, the state of Oregon is very different, the west side of the Cascades and the east side of the Cascades. And there's a lot of political tension that comes from the fact that those two different cultures are always playing tug of war over one state government to force policy from one side to the other. Everybody would be better off if we moved the state line so that people on the east side of the state could get government that matches their values, matches their culture, and people on the west side of the state could get government that matches their values and their culture.
Matt McCaw is with the Greater Idaho Movement. Thanks very much for the conversation, Matt.
Thank you, Libby.
Oregon and Idaho are not the only states that have toyed with the idea of shifting borders in recent years. There have been pushes to get some counties in western Maryland to join West Virginia. Activists in parts of Colorado would like to join Wyoming. The list goes on. What does the rise of secession movements say about the state of our democracy in 2023? University of Oregon political science professor Joe Lowndes focuses on populism along with conservatism and social movements in the U.S. And I asked him about the ideology and political maneuvering driving the Greater Idaho movement.
It's an interesting kind of political development. In some ways, the aims of the movement are specific and logistical, to move the borders of Idaho to encompass 12 or 14 counties in Oregon. But it's also strongly ideological, as you suggested, and probably as Matt McCaw said. And there's a number of things here that, you know, that would put it in a, you know, would mark it as a right-wing movement. You know, often if you talk to organizers, you'll hear that it's, you know, these are rural values versus urban values. But, you know, there's no inherent politics to living in a rural area or being a farmer or a rancher, just as there's no inherent clear politics that one would necessarily have by living in a city, by living in Portland or Salem or Eugene. So as a matter of fact, if you had asked residents of Eastern or Southern Oregon what rural values meant, you know, 100 years ago during the populist movement, rural values would have meant holding the, you know, the big financial interests accountable, to having greater regulation over the banks, to have greater regulation over, you know, the steel industry, the railroads, what the populace called the big interests. This is an historically specific movement, and it reflects the politics of its organizers, which is, you know, not to say that it reflects everybody's political values in Eastern and Southern Oregon, although these are largely more conservative districts and counties. But, you know, the things that they will emphasize in their literature, there are, you know, issues of, they raise critical race theory, which, you know, as we know, is a kind of a national touchstone, kind of hot button issue for school boards that right-wing movements have pushed. Transgender issues, which, again, there's nothing inherently rural or urban about transgender issues, but, you know, they discuss having males and girls sports leagues, which is, you know, one of the trigger things for kind of an anti-trans agenda. Statewide COVID mandates.
Some of the key culture war touch points that we've seen play out on the national stage for years now.
Yes, absolutely. And in particular, the last couple of years, when you know, come to some of these things involving school boards, particularly critical race theory and trans issues. And reproductive rights is another one. I think one interesting thing about this is a vote that just happened in Wallawa County to get the county to begin discussing the issue. And there was a very close vote. And within, last I checked, within 7 votes, I think. And I'm not sure how it's going to turn out. But one interesting thing to note about it is that was the first county where there was an organized opposition to the measure. And none of the other states were, you know, was this kind of energy and activity put in. And here there was. And it's interesting to see that, you know, I think Western State Strategies, who were kind of organizing the opposition, they came in very late in the game with a few TV ads and some mailers. And that alone was enough to kind of help people on the ground decide, like, well, wait a second, is this actually what I want? Is this really what I want to see happen? And so if you give people vehicles for democratic expression, that can go in any number of directions. The Greater Idaho Movement helped people organize the expression of their beliefs and values in one direction. And, you know, this opposition to it allows people to express their opposition to that in another way.
So while 11 counties previously have voted for these advisory measures to have their county commissioners talk about Greater Idaho, once there was some momentum on the other side, the vote was much closer and potentially, we still don't have the tally yet, but potentially could fail.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And I think that's instructive, that for people who want to involve themselves, you know, the old adage that, you know, the answer to democracy is always more democracy. The answer to protest is more democracy. And that's what we see here is once, you know, the greater possibilities of political expression here means that you actually get a more interesting outcome.
The Greater Idaho Movement, that's not the only proposal that we've seen over the years to change state borders. There have been through lines with movements to create, say, a state of Jefferson in Northern California and Southern Oregon, or the state of Liberty in Eastern Washington, something that former state representative here in Washington, Matt Shea, has espoused. And you hear similar messaging that the rural values of these areas don't match up with the capital city and the urban centers and the real political power in states like Washington and Oregon. Do you see a through line in these movements with what's happening with Greater Idaho?
Whenever anyone talks about changing borders, or the cousin of changing borders, which is secession, it marks that there's a claim that people are not getting represented and they cannot be represented, which is to say they are being ruled illegitimately in a way. So there's a strong, a very potent politics there. And you know, the politics of different secessionist movements or movements to change borders have had different political valences over time. There was the Sagebrush Rebellion of the 1970s, which was a pushback by ranchers against the Bureau of Land Management around use of federal land for grazing purposes, which, you know, ended up having a violent edge to it. There were a number of bombings of BLM buildings and kind of begin to be declarations of people claiming that they are not, you know, they can't legitimately be ruled by the federal government. And the Sagebrush Rebellion was, you know, widespread across, you know, across the West. In the 1990s, the militia movement emerged across, you know, across the country, but particularly across the West. Again, the claim that, you know, people's sovereignty ended at the county level. Some of this came from the, you know, the ideology of the Posse Comitatus movement, which was a explicitly white supremacist movement calling for county rule, led by white supremacists in the wake of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that county should not have to be beholden to federal laws around civil rights. Which is not to say that this is a white supremacist movement. I would reject that depiction of it, but you do have these kinds of, you know, right-wing and far-right antecedents for this movement. And a lot of it has, you know, some of the same messaging.
Your list of some of the history of secessionist and independence movements in the Pacific Northwest made me think of Ammon Bundy. Of course, the showdown in the Malheur Wildlife area in southeastern Oregon, another sort of sovereignty individuals against rule by a government that they don't find legitimate, sort of a long, proud history of that in the Pacific Northwest that we see through today. Now, some supporters of the Greater Idaho Movement say that this campaign is necessary because they have no chance at getting any of their policy goals enacted when population centers like Portland, Eugene are really where the majority of voters are, the majority of legislators, the legislative power emanates from. What does the call for leaving Oregon instead of fighting for policy goals in the democratic process as it exists say about where we are as a country and our political division?
It's important to know or remember that Oregon always had almost a distinct history of political cooperation across party lines. There were moderate Republicans who were dominant in the state legislature and in the governor's office for many, many decades. The Republican Party here looked a lot like New England Republicans. And so you can think of people who were, you know, kind of Republican mavericks, very important ones from the state, who were moderate and independent minded. You can think of Mark Hatfield or Bob Packwood or Wayne Morse. So these were, you know, there's a history here of Oregon's Republican Party being far more moderate than it is today. It began to, a right wing turn, a really sharply right wing turn in the mid 1990s, and has continued kind of rightward since then. And again, particularly since 2016, it's kind of lurched rightward again. The Democratic Party in Oregon has always been kind of a reform-minded party that has not gone lockstep with the National Democratic Party. But I think that, you know, the Democratic Party has responded to economic issues in the last decade by moving further to the left, somewhat further left, you know, it's still kind of a center left party, in ways that I think have become intolerable to people on the right, both around economic issues and social issues. The question, what does this mean in terms of national politics? This is really an important reflection of what's happening at the national level. I mean, it seems, you know, Oregon seems to have been in the last 6 or 7 years continuing on the front lines of kind of the politics we see nationally. And, you know, there are urban rural divides nationally, which partly have to do with culture and politics. They partly have to do with money. Urban areas are economic centers, and rural areas are increasingly depleted financially and in terms of their economic ability to compete. So there's something here that we have to track specifically about what it means when money has migrated to the city. And there's been, you know, in an era of free trade agreements, Oregon has lost pulp mills and lost, you know, lots of things in the timber industry. Some people blame environmentalism, but it's really the free trade agreements have done much more damage. So I think nationally you see more wealth concentrating in cities. And so there is a kind of a class politics to this, but there is also kind of a national sharp political division where people, particularly in the internet age, are siloed into seeing things politically in very within bubbles, and kind of an increasing lack of tolerance to have debate, to have discussion, to hammer out possible alternatives. You know, there's you know, disinformation, there's conspiracy theories. So I think we are actually, you know, nationally, we are headed towards sharply divided political visions, whether or not there's even a, you know, belief in democracy in some sectors, or what democracy is or means. And, you know, as we've seen, it's turned, particularly since the emergence of the Tea Party movement in the mid-2000s, it's become increasingly violent as well. And the possible alternatives have become increasingly violent.
At the end of the day, of course, Professor, the likelihood of Greater Idaho succeeding is very slim. Can you talk to me about the obstacles, just the political, logistical obstacles to actually moving the Idaho-Oregon border?
So in order to actually move the border, you would have to have both the states of Oregon and Idaho agree that this is what they would want to have happen. There was a bill that moved through, to begin considering it, that moved through the Idaho House that stalled in the Senate and it has not gone anywhere and likely will not. It's almost inconceivable that it would get any traction at all in the Oregon legislature. If it were somehow to get agreement in Oregon and Idaho, then the U.S. Congress would have to vote to make the change. And so there are major obstacles along the way, and it makes it almost impossible to imagine it happening. Now, having said that, impossible things happen in politics, so that's true. But what it means is that we have to think about this partly as less a kind of an administrative shift and more of political movement, a political movement with political ideas and political visions of what people want to see happen. And I think at some level, it has strategic value for Republicans in the state legislature in Salem, who, you know, right now actually are in the middle of a walkout, which means that no legislation can be voted on. And this has been happening repeatedly. And so what we're having is really kind of an inability to have any politics happen at all. But I think the combination of these walkouts and the Greater Idaho movement is an attempt to force Democrats in the state legislature and the governor's office to move rightward on issues that conservative activists want to see happen.
Professor Joe Lowndes, thank you so much for joining us. Professor Lowndes is a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's terrific to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.